Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is T.V. Paul, who is the James McGill Professor of International Relations in the Department of Political Science at McGill University, Montreal, Canada. He's the author or editor of 12 books, including The Tradition of Non-Use of Nuclear Weapons and The India-Pakistan Conflict. Welcome, T.V.
Thank you for having me here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in a state called Kerala, which is the southernmost part of India. If you look at the map of India, it's the tip of India, facing the Arabian Sea. Small town near Kottayam, which is also very well known for its literary achievements. A lot of press there, and very impressive place in terms of its natural beauty.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
My father didn't have much education, but had a great admiration for history, and he would read textbooks of British history, British Indian history, and would talk to us as kids about the good things the British have done. Unfortunately, he was a little on the bias toward in favor of the British. That really instilled a lot of thinking in me at that time. And so I would read newspapers, listen to various radio stations. And through over the years, you know, acquired a real interest in international affairs. When I was growing up, there's also Vietnam War was going on, and also some conflict in the India-Pakistan side. So conflict was very much in the news. Mm-hmm. And that sort of attracted my attention, why these things are happening, and I wanted to know.
And where were you educated, and did you pick up these themes in your education, both in secondary school and then college?
Secondary school was very basic education, as in India, as everywhere. History is only one subject, political science not really taught. Civics, yes, a little bit. But in college, I took courses in politics and economics and history. And bachelor's was in political science, but master's, did one master's in Kerala also, a college called Maharaja's College, which affiliated to the Kerala University in the city of Cochin, which is again in southern state of Kerala. And then my great advancement in terms of interest occurred when I moved to New Delhi, where I was also working as a part-time journalist with the Press Trust of India, working as a foreign news editor, sub-editor sort of thing. And then studying at the Jawaharlal Nehru University, India's premier institution to study international studies, where I studied disarmament, arms control, international politics, those sort of, and did an MPhil there. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I moved on to Australia, University of Queensland for a year. But I didn't continue there. In between, I got admitted to UCLA here in California, and did my PhD under a well-known political scientist called Richard Rosenkranz, who is now at Harvard. He was a great teacher in terms of pushing me to think big picture IR rather than focusing purely on regions.
Mm-hmm. And I'd be curious, because you said you were a journalist, as you were getting this education, and we'll get you to UCLA in a minute, was there a interplay between what you were studying in terms of history and political science on the one hand, and then also editing material on current events?
Very much so. I was often in charge of distributing the international news to the whole of Indian media through this network they had. So I would pick the news, you know, which one goes, which one doesn't go, which one I would cut. They sort of, because they only can publicize only so much. There's a kind of a centralized distribution network. Beyond that, what struck me was the need for more in-depth understanding of international relations. And as a journalist working with the news agency, I wasn't quite satisfied that I couldn't say things in a news clip or whatever, you know. So I started taking classes and realized that my true call is a sort of academic, but in such a way that it will at least appeal to a slightly broader audience than pure theoretical people, but I was very impressed with the need to understand international relations theory and apply that into policy-relevant issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, what at UCLA, working under Rosecrans, what did you do your dissertation on?
I worked on a topic called asymmetric conflicts, war initiation by weaker powers. I looked at different wars, and one of the things that struck me was the relative little attention given to the fact that many wars in history are started by weaker powers, relatively weaker powers. So even in the India-Pakistan conflict, out of the four wars, three of them were initiated by the weaker side, relatively weaker side, that's Pakistan. And so my puzzle was, why is it so, and why is this literature doesn't give much allowance to that? Dominant literature says if you're strong, the other guy won't start a war. So then I looked back at history, and I selected seven cases from the 20th century, the Russo-Japanese War, the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Chinese intervention in Korea, the Egyptian offensive in 73, before that the 65 Pakistan offensive against India, then the Falklands. So I tried to look at some common threats, and I found that strategy that these smaller powers have matter a lot. They are looking for limited gains, territorial gains often, or they are not expecting major retaliation from the stronger side. So the calculations that they have affect their decision-making choices, and they try to circumvent the superior powers' material capabilities. Sometimes they could succeed, or they want to create what you call a fait accompli situation, as Sadat in 1973, forcing the other side to negotiate. Which came out as a book from Cambridge University Press and did very well as a work.
Yeah, and it would seem to be a topic that's increasingly important today. Let's talk about international relations, because this background of yours is interesting in terms of actually covering events as a journalist or looking at the coverage of events. What have you gotten from international relations theory that you didn't have before you undertook your course of studies?
I think the big issue for understanding world politics is whether theoretical tools are necessary or not. There is a group of people who would say internationalist theory doesn't make any difference. You can just analyze. My inclination is there is a difference between description and analysis or explanation. I'm interested in explanation, but not in such a way that avoiding description to some extent, because you can't avoid that. I'm also interested in eclectic theorizing, which means I'm very uneasy with the notion of pigeonholing international relations theory as we have done in realism or liberalism or constructivism, because I see phenomena are much diverse, very difficult to say this exactly explains everything in international, or actually shouldn't explain everything, but the fact that explanations sometimes have to tailor to particular topics, particular issues, particular contexts. And I think my big pitch has been look at the puzzle rather than just the paradigm. If the puzzle tells you that realism or the approach that we have in international relations is useful, use it. But not to say that there may be other puzzles that may require combination of approaches or even the application of another perspective. Now, that makes you a little bit wishy-washy in the face of critics, but I think many disciplines are moving in that direction. Comparative politics, for instance, is a lot more puzzle-driven now. IR is not yet because of our attachment to the core theoretical perspectives. So I do think that theory is needed. Without that, we will be describing events. Just because we don't have deep theoretical understanding today doesn't mean that we should abandon it. We should pursue. At the same time, be sensitive to the weaknesses of theory. Theory is not everything. A theory cannot explain everything. But at the same time, approaches are needed, methodologies are needed. And this, I think, students should be aware that when they, even critical theory sometimes don't want to talk about it, but the point is that how else social science will advance. So it's a matter of appreciating and using some of the tools, and in my case, developing puzzles and explaining them.
International relations is the study of international anarchy. What are the qualities that students should bring to the table or develop in order to study, especially if you're studying the international system, the there that doesn't seem to be there? Is there a particular approach to thinking other than the ability to deal with complexity, which you just described?
I think students should be open-minded. Many a times, even we try to impose on students certain perspectives and they try to bias or try to follow our lead. I think that's a mistake. They should have the freedom to choose their topic or particular perspectives. They should also be willing to listen to the opposite points of view, because often we don't do that properly. So if you want to do good IR, you have to really pay attention to what the other side is saying. You don't have to agree, but make sure when you disagree properly, taking up the arguments rather than the individuals or, you know, whatever ideology or whatever. I'm also uneasy with ideological IR. My uneasiness is that it's sort of conclusions are already drawn before even the analysis starts. I have no problem people taking ideological points of view, but the point is that then do a proper analysis and either prove or disprove. And one should be humble enough to say my hypothesis does not work. Just a case of a Marxist analysis. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm a Marxist, but in this particular analysis, afterwards, I realize it just doesn't make sense. How many Marxists do that? I mean, this applies to many other perspectives. Mm-hmm. This is one issue that I've been always puzzled. I mean, if you are a social scientist, use the word social science. Science is never 100% correct. No, everything is testable and then disprovable. So in that sense, we have to be a little bit more open to counter viewpoints. Sometimes it's difficult, but students especially have to be encouraged to think critically. You know, even if their belief system they come with need not agree with this particular point of view that they are studying.
When you say ideological, you mean the theory becomes ideological, or do you mean, are you also suggesting that the theory might be related to the national interests of a particular country where the theorists abide?
Both are there. One is theory becoming dogma. Mm-hmm. In other words, you cannot question the theory, you know, mm-hmm. or the argument behind that perspective. The other is my country is always right, sort of thing. So theories are used to explain particular behavior, but at the same time, rarely critical analysis comes out because our national interest or we have a higher purpose, you know, the other guy doesn't get it, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. In today's world, that especially is very important, like rise of China. And it would be very interesting to see how Chinese scholars look at IR. And in fact, they are looking very closely. And is that going to be purely kind of a nationalistic understanding of China's rise? What does China want? You know, what is the order that China is going to create? So how much criticism they can put forward, as in the United States history, we have different theories and arguments, you know, liberals versus conservatives, libertarians, and different groups trying to question the existing paradigms. How much that is possible in the Chinese context? And if that is not possible, what does that tell for the 21st century or when China will be the hegemonic power? So I think it is very important that we socialize or help to socialize scholars, not just in the United States, but in emerging countries like China, India, or Brazil, about the need for hard thinking and ability to question established wisdom if those wisdoms are not going to do the right thing for world peace or disarmament or global order or whatever you are seeking.
You suggested earlier that you had a background in history because of your father, and I would
a little bit. I can't say much, but I'm
interested.
Well,
but you were attuned to its importance.
Yes.
So I would imagine for political scientists who do IR, history becomes very important.
Absolutely.
And interdisciplinary studies, you've always suggested, but also what we call area or regional studies.
Yes.
So talk a little about that, because the granular data is sometimes very different from the elegant, simplistic domain of theorizing.
Yes. History is our real data source for most of the kind of thing, especially for my work. I mentioned my dissertation. Essentially, I was reading historical books and trying to make sense of, is there a causal pattern out there, a mechanism that I can outline. Every work I have done has got all the things you're mentioning, history, regional focus. Given my South Asia focus, I have also tried to apply these theories, drawing from South Asian examples as well as applying that to South Asian context. I think it is a bit of a weakness of South Asian studies, especially in the international relations area. Very few deep scholarly works are done, even in India. Unfortunately, a lot more focus is on Indian foreign policy or day-to-day issues. As a result, we don't get a broader picture of why certain things are happening. For instance, why did India acquire nuclear weapons after 25 years grappling with it? So we need to understand what conditions emerged, what conditions changed, and can we then understand this as a pattern, a process, and what are the consequences? So for me, this region, South Asia, gives me a lot of ammunition for understanding international politics, even though some of the things are specific to the region, but there are a lot of commonalities with other regions.
And it's in looking at your book on Pakistan-India conflict, which we'll talk about in a minute, there is an important interplay between domestic politics and international politics.
Absolutely.
And how does one prepare to pursue that, basically, as a scholar?
It is a big challenge because there is a tendency to ignore one dimension, or the unit-level dimension, as we call it, to the broader systemic or subsystemic context, which is the regional or international level. My effort in this particular volume was to bring together a group of scholars, ask them, what really is causing the persistence of this conflict? It has been over 60 years, it's going on. It doesn't look like there is an end point in sight. It has ups and downs. You have wars, you have crises, militarized crises, sometimes very intense. And now these are nuclearized powers. And there is this asymmetric war going on. Insurgents enter Indian side of Kashmir, engage in a kind of conflict. Sometimes India shoots back. And as you noticed last year, there was a major attack on Mumbai. Trained insurgents or terrorists, if you want to call them, from Pakistan entering through the Arabian Sea. This generated intense pressures to react. They didn't use any kind of military resort. But the point is that the relations are now really in a low level. They're trying to force some kind of negotiation, but it's not working. So the rivalry has deep causes. And the question is, what are those deep causes? And there I do see the rivalry is caused by both international and domestic level forces, factors.
Mm. Let me show the book that we're talking about, the India-Pakistan conflict, which you edited, An Enduring Rivalry. And let me ask this question before we get into the causes. Does a book like this contribute to the policy debate? I'm asking you a bigger question. Mm-hmm. To what extent do theoretical studies based in case studies, do they inform how we should think and act in our policy decisions?
Absolutely. This literature on enduring rivalries offers a set of conditions that generate rivalry, for instance. Mm-hmm. Most rivalries are not enduring. They end after a period of time. Mm-hmm. But if certain conditions emerge, you can get this sort of long-lasting conflict dynamics. So what are those conditions? And it is important to realize that those conditions have to change. Some are beyond the control of the state, others are within the control of the political elite. They may have to take certain actions, certain steps, but sometimes whatever they do don't seem to work. This happens in the India-Pakistan conflict. Mm-hmm. Because in 1999, the Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, civilian leader, and Indian Prime Minister at that time, Mr. Bajpayee, had a meeting in Lahore, which the Pakistani military simply could not stand because they somehow thought there could be peace breaking, and the military thwarted that by starting the Kargil War. There, you see the domestic politics of Pakistan entering into this dynamics. So why is that so? I mean, because military is a stakeholder in the Pakistani context. They have their understanding of what kind of peace they want. If the civilians are talking in a different kind of peace, they are afraid they will not support that peace. So this domestic dimension is also helped by international dimension. Today, for instance, in the Afghanistan-Pakistan context, the intervention of external powers is a major factor in the way the conflict has evolved, starting with the Soviet invasion, then the American counter-offensive supported by Pakistan, and the way the conflict ended in 1989. Since then, we all know the rise of the Taliban. But this process is both internal and external. There's that interaction going on. And so actors have to realize that some of the things they do may be causing this conflict. They should be prepared for ending that. For instance, after 89, the U.S. should have paid more attention to that area. Mm-hmm. Just left. And giving it to the Pakistani ISI, as we call this Taliban control, and allowing the victory of Taliban later on. Today we are going to witness somewhat similar situation. So the question is, what can we do? And then the other big picture is, what sort of institutions have to be created? Mm-hmm. In South Asia is institution deficient. They don't have many institutions like Southeast Asia. Economic interdependence is limited. Democracy is also pretty limited. So these are three core things that are needed for what you call the liberal peace or the Kantian peace. And so there, the leaders have to take certain steps. So a book like this would urge them to think of ways to achieve peace, even when certain structural conditions don't allow that. But those conditions sometimes can be overcome by concrete choices the leaders make.
And to talk briefly about the causes, these essays in this book suggest is that the conflict is embedded in history, it's embedded in the political identity, especially of Pakistan, but of both parties. Mm-hmm. It is embedded in irredentism, where there is disagreement about where the border should be, especially with regard to Kashmir. Mm-hmm. So then over time, institutions build up that have a vested interest in continuing these conflicts going. Yeah. Now, you've already suggested and reminded of the recent history where the big players, the Soviet Union toward the end of the Cold War and the United States, were playing a game that essentially used these conflicts, one would have to say.
I would say that these countries' leaders also use the conflict for their advantage.
Right. So there's an interplay at the local level, and at the international level.
Right.
And then, of course, the other thing, which we'll talk about in a minute, is the technology drive produces a situation where both parties come to have nuclear weapons. So you really create a tinderbox, a situation of great volatility.
Right. I just edited another volume Stanford University Press is going to publish. It's called South Asia's Weak States, Understanding the Enduring Conflict in the Region, why this region has so much conflict. There I am suggesting that two critical variables. One is you have the presence of weak states, but you also have the presence of weak norms of cooperation. Now, these may be caused by other factors. One of the things there I identify, countries like Pakistan, for instance, are weak, but at the same time in a lopsided way. They have the coercive power to use force against themselves, their domestic opposition, as well as outside. So as long as this lopsided power they have, coercive power they have, they're not going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
But they will continue engaging in a conflict dynamics. And now we have the nuclear factor, which brings in a big dimension, bigger dimension, in terms of deterrence, in terms of stability, mutual understanding of the limits and possibilities of the nuclear weapons. So those are some of the things I talk, or the chapters talk in this book and the forthcoming book.
Yeah. Now, you're raising an interesting question as we talk about the domestic politics and the role of the Pakistani army in making difficulties for a settlement process, or the ISI, the Pakistani Army's Intelligence Unit, which was a key actor in supporting the Mujahideen, and which has been over time a key actor in supporting the Taliban. And the issue that it raises theoretically is, what are the units we're talking about? Because in IR, we like to think, well, we've got Pakistan here and India there, but what really seems to be very important is the role of subgroups with power, as you just said, the power to coerce.
Yes, that's a very interesting point that sometimes IR people don't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we need to look at the literature on civil-military relations. There was literature on garrison state, especially in the Latin American context. But there is a lot of IR ideas about interstate notions, about power, about great power relations, about deterrence, all these things. But to understand Pakistan, it's impossible just to say it's all about international relations.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot about the way international forces affected domestic structures, how Pakistan was trying to cope with this security dilemma that it or its elite thought it was facing from India. So partition takes place, then you have a short period of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was the founding father, literally for 1 year. No political party emerges properly, unlike in India where Nehru helps the creation of a Congress party and sustaining institutions. So here it becomes a bureaucratic elite, and the bureaucratic elite just had no understanding of democracy. Over a period of time, military takes over, and the military creates a sort of a garrison state. And then you have all these conflicts. In order to fight these conflicts, they created these subcategories like the intelligence unit, and later on supporting the non-state actors to fight in Kashmir. And it created a huge establishment where, as you said, multiple stakeholders, and the civilians occasionally win power. They try to control. It's always a hybrid system. Even today, there is a civilian government, but they don't have the actual power when it comes to national security decisions. This, I think, has to be understood in the context of its domestic politics and within the dynamics of the regional and the importance China and the United States play. And they tend to sometimes support the military because that is the most interesting or important actor in the Pakistani society.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that dynamics which it cannot break that dynamics. Even though today the United States would like to see the civilian government becoming stronger, but the military is the one that is going to fight in Waziristan or in other parts of border with Afghanistan.
We're doing this interview at a time when President Obama is making critical decisions about Afghanistan. And the Afghan war is clearly intertwined with the situation in Pakistan, as we're coming to know in the press here. But in addition, the history of the recent history of this conflict relates to India. The recent bombing, one of the recent bombings in Afghanistan, was near the Indian embassy. So it's you're laying out here kind of an enduring conflict that did not cease to exist when the Cold War ended, and in fact it was almost as if it got the conflict got new life after the pivotal event of 9/11, which changed the focus to terrorism. Talk a little about that. I mean, is there, you would, an IR person, one would think that when the bipolar world ended, that somehow these conflicts would come to a resolution.
Yeah, that is the very interesting part, because the Cold War was affecting the region, but it was not determining the regional conflict. There's already conflict going on. And these two actors have their own strengths. They are not just any banana republics, as we want to call them. Mm-hmm. There's deeper reasons here, which most people ignore, the historical reasons. The British Empire, as you know, had a strategy of keeping Afghanistan as a kind of a buffer. Under its hegemony, they fought a couple of wars, failed all the time. Mm-hmm. And that way, not letting the Russian Empire to penetrate to the Indian Ocean, Arabian Sea area, which they're looking for warm water. Now, the Pakistanis have sort of adopted this notion that Afghanistan should be under their control, or at least should not be closer to India. India views that Afghanistan and Central Asia as part of its own periphery. It's culturally and historically, several invasions came from that part of the world. The Mughal Empire, you know, was coming from Central Asia. The thousand-year-old Islamic invasions of India. And so India views that its own Central Asia is part of its periphery too. But Pakistan also views this, that it should not allow Afghanistan to fall into any kind of government that would be sympathetic to India. And Afghanistan, other than the Taliban or groups like that, are quite sympathetic to India, because they are also having a conflict with Pakistan over the Pashtun areas, and also the question of the Durand Line, which is the British imposed. So there is that interaction going on. India today provides quite a bit of economic assistance, billions of dollars actually, roads are constructed. But the Pakistanis believe that India has a larger agenda, and I don't know the truth, but clearly it is not as militarily oriented as, because the U.S. doesn't allow that either. But the Afghanis themselves, Karzai likes India because some of their elite studied in India. They have a deep connection. Because if tomorrow U.S. leaves, for these folks, it's India that their only hope they have, and Russia to some extent. So it is the problem is an understanding by both India and Pakistan that Afghanistan should be an independent country. It should make its own choices. Of course, it should be somewhat neutral in sense. But to expect a kind of hegemony over Afghanistan, this comes out of the British era thinking. And I have been talking about it over the years, that Pakistan has to change. If it wants a good relationship with Afghanistan, it has to think of ways to let Afghanistan also survive and emerge and prosper as a nation state, which is not easy given the Pashtun divisions and the redentism going on that level also.
There's an irony here. When Richard Holbrooke was appointed to be the special envoy, I think his original title was special envoy to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Mm-hmm. And then the Indians asked that latter part, that is a special envoy to India, be removed.
Yes.
So it's as if there is a real resistance to seeing the big picture, which you have to see to solve the problem, as you've explained.
Yeah, but they do not want, at least Indians don't want external powers to dictate or tell them how to solve the Kashmir problem, which they always find very hard to accept. This also shows a self-image that India has about as a rising power, as a rising great power, that its problem with Pakistan should be dealt bilaterally. They don't want China to get involved, because China also is a stakeholder in the Kashmir conflict. And they have some lingering doubts about the U.S. policies in the past. The U.S. sided with Pakistan sometimes. Under the Clinton administration, after the Kargil conflict, it became somewhat pro-India, because the Clinton administration thought the Pakistanis were adventurous in the nuclear context. And then under Bush, they kept a kind of equidistance on Kashmir. But Bush was a big promoter of India, as you know, the India-U.S. nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. And Bush is well-respected in India. So is the current president, but the point is that Bush was the first one to treat India differently than other U.S. presidents. So that clearly shows that the American policy could change, and there was some interpretation about the Obama administration's initial approach to Pakistan and Kashmir. And as a result, this was forced in, the administration took it away. In a way, it is good, I think, because you don't want to mess up with this Afghan conflict with Kashmir, and it's going to be very difficult to solve all of them at the same time, even though ideally it is what we need.
This is a good point to segue into the other book I want to discuss with you, your book published by Stanford, The Tradition of Non-Use of Nuclear Weapons. And the problem before you was, how is it that after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, nuclear weapons have not been used? And what was your finding?
Mm-hmm. This was a long-standing project that I have been working. Even from my graduate days, I attended a talk by Thomas Schelling at UCLA, and I thought, oh, nobody has written a book on this, why nuclear weapons haven't been used since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There are two theories or dominant theories out there. One is the notion of deterrence, mutual deterrence, that the U.S.-Soviet Cold War relationship was mutual deterrent, neither could use it against each other. The question that here I address is, why haven't the nuclear states used it against non-nuclear states? For instance, in Korea, in Vietnam, where the nuclear powers, Korea was a stalemate but did not win. Vietnam also the same thing. And there were considerable thought, especially in the U.S. administration, both Truman and Eisenhower, and later on in even Nixon period, about the possibility of using nuclear weapons against the Chinese and the Vietnamese and all that. So why hasn't that been used? And the prevailing wisdom is that maybe it was because it just wouldn't provide the benefits that we're looking at. And I went and looked at the archival materials, and I found some other pattern is also working much more powerfully, which is what I call reputation and image. United States used this weapon against Japan, and it was a very powerful event in human history. It created considerable questions about the ethics and morality, etc. So there was a 2-3 year period where you have great effort to create a nuclear-free world. The effort to create, there was a Baruch plan, and the plan was that both the Soviets and the United States would give it up under international control, at the same time creating civilian energy. But that didn't last, as 1949, the Soviets tested. And then the Korean War started, a major theater where nuclear use was contemplated, but did not happen. And then the Pacific Test in the 50s, the big hydrogen bomb, etc. From there onwards, a sort of a tradition or a normative prohibition against nuclear weapon use emerged. Of course, it had ups and downs. And then you have the 60s, the Test Ban Treaty, Cuban Missile Crisis also forced people to think about the difficulties to use nuclear weapons. You have the NPT or the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which implicitly created this notion of you cannot use it against non-nuclear states. And so it was a process evolving, but some people call this some kind of a taboo against the use of nuclear weapons. I like to call it a sort of slightly lower level because nuclear states have plans to use them under certain conditions. A taboo, you don't even consider that particular option. So this tradition has emerged, and it has tremendous ramifications for non-proliferation, how developing countries or non-nuclear states look at the nuclear weapon states. And I have also the approaches of other states like China, Russia, India, Pakistan, and Israel, whether they were influenced. And my finding is that they were influenced in a limited way. Finally, I was writing then the Bush administration was thinking of changing the strategy and developing mini nukes and things like that. And that is what prompted me to argue that this tradition is in the interest of the United States. It is not a wise thing to break it for limited purposes or even to prevent a country from getting nuclear weapons, because breaking may have long-lasting consequences. That would mean other countries may want to get nuclear weapons to prevent them being used. So the fact that it has both history in it, both theory in it, and some policy prescriptions, it's attracting some interest among scholars and policymakers, and hopefully it will have some more impact. And I do find the Obama administration is changing its policies in a way that I would like to see too. So clearly there is some sense among decision makers that we can't go too far with nuclear weapons or changing strategies in a world where complexity is emerging in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Now, there seem when you think about using nuclear weapons, there are really two purposes. One is to deter the adversary, and it would seem that the constraints that you've identified, the normative constraints, may not apply to your old focus, namely weaker states. That is, states that are emerging, and let's focus on Iran, basically, that it would seem that it works the opposite way, that to acquire a nuclear weapon would enhance their reputation, basically. Not to say that they would use it. Talk a little about that, because it would seem that the strategies of the big powers, whether it's democratization, whether it's intervention, what lies behind it is the notion that we will intervene in your affairs. And these emerging states, such as Iran, see a nuclear weapon as a way to protect themselves from that.
Right. This is a fascinating area if you want to look at the way Iran is approaching nuclear weapons, or this idea with the desire to prevent, like you said, intervention by others, and a deterrent against its regional power, especially Israel. Israel has nuclear weapons. But the outside world fears that Iran will break the tradition. Mm-hmm. Iran is not going to be bound by this notion of normative prohibition because it is not socialized into it. Or it has ambitions to dominate the region. So even the Gulf countries, the Muslim countries themselves fear that Iranian nuclear weapons are bad news. Part of it is the fear that it is a revolutionary regime, and it makes, or its leaders make, statements that are kind of revolutionary or challenging the status quo, or sometimes outright denial of the other side's existence, such as the Holocaust denial, etc. So it generates a lot of fear among the regional states. What if this country gets nuclear weapons? Right now, its capabilities are only conventional. Will it use it for purposes beyond deterrence? And that is also driving United States to some extent. But I think Israel many Israelis truly believe that Iran will try to use this capability for its purposes beyond, or it will transfer weapon to non-state actors, etc. My reading is that it's maybe we are reading too much into it. Mm-hmm. We had revolutionary states before acquiring nuclear weapons. Stalin, Mao, and Mao had a cultural revolution. It's a pretty nasty one, no? We have North Korea today, which is also very unpredictable. The irony is that once countries get nuclear weapons, there is an initial period of uncertainty. They are not sure what they get. This toy is quite tempting. And Pakistan, by the way, tried to use the toy to get Kashmir, as the Kargil was an effort. Mm-hmm. And even today, using that cover for the asymmetric war. But there is a point in time leaders tend to realize there's only so much you can do with nuclear weapons. If you go too far, you are in trouble. You can use some point of it. But my own reading, the Iranians are going to take a little bit of time, but they are not going to be anything totally different from what we have witnessed historically. Because if they use nuclear weapons, there won't be an Iranian state. The other, you know, Israel has 300, 400 weapons. Of course, it's mutual. But the only nasty thing I can think of is they are giving this capability to non-state actors. Even that, looking at the Iranian behavior, what have they really done so badly? I mean, it's not clear they are going to be the big challengers. They will make noises, So in a sense, it is a socialization of the Iranian elite that is needed. That would mean a lot more interaction with them, Western scholars as well as others who have experienced the nuclear weapon say, these are the things you can and you cannot do. And that process needs a little bit more arms control regime can be created. I think we are missing that opportunity by using a coercive approach towards Iran or vice versa. But so there is a period that is crucial here.
Now, as you say, there were many revolutionary states that have acquired nuclear weapons. What about this, namely that the tradition of non-use is a set of secular values, we could say, and that. Do you worry at all about religious regimes, you know, in which the apocalypse or bringing a new world into existence based on religious texts, does that in any way affect your thinking about who acquires nuclear ability on the one hand, and on the other hand, does it require additional constraints, or is the religious ideology just another ideology? And once people have state power and have nuclear weapons, they move to this non-use set of norms.
This is one issue I discussed with, and I came to the conclusion that most states, almost all states, are not going to be users of this thing, even if they are run by religious-driven forces. But the greatest fear I have expressed that is the non-state actors or cataclysmic non-state actors. In today's world, you have the Al-Qaeda probably is the closest. Mm-hmm. The Japanese group was also there, but they, I think, are not that effective anymore. Even Al-Qaeda, there are these people argue that their goal also is domination of the world rather than destruction in a way that they won't be able to dominate. So where are they going to use it? If they use nuclear weapons against other Muslim countries, what sort of sympathy they're going to get among these countries? If they use against non-Muslim countries, then reaction could be pretty bad too. So, but there is great uncertainty what they can do with nuclear materials, the dirty bomb, for instance. The big challenge is going to be rogue scientists, or as in the case of Pakistan, you have a couple of scientists trying to give...
A.Q. Khan.
A.Q. Khan included. But more than A.Q. Khan, there's few people who were supporting the Al-Qaeda, giving them blueprints, etc. Actually, the U.S., when it invaded Afghanistan, discovered some of these blueprints from caves. And that is very risky. In order to prevent, we really need to get a hold on what Pakistan, who controls the Pakistani weapons as well as facilities, and whether if something happens to the central leadership of Pakistan, will these things go into the hands of the non-state actors. Beyond that, I don't see regimes, countries themselves doing it. Countries are easy targets. Mm-hmm. They're sitting ducks. Mm-hmm. If tomorrow... say Pakistan or Afghanistan leaders we know did something really nasty, you can, you know, engage in a strike that will finish them off, no? So in that sense, what they would do is they, you know, elements may support these non-state actors. But it is not as easy as we think that even in that case to develop a proper usable nuclear weapon and engage in maximum damage, because you need certain altitude, you need certain kind of technology to achieve that. So far, as we know, not many groups have done or achieved that, but future is unpredictable as technology is evolving.
Mm-hmm. I know you're working on a new book on globalization and national security, and you're head of a project at McGill working on that. What do you see in globalization after the economic collapse that might threaten some of the certainties that we've developed about national security, about non-use of nuclear weapons, and so on? Is it primarily the empowerment of non state actors with malicious purpose because of their ideology?
We were actually testing, a colleague of mine, Noren Rifsman and myself, testing some of the propositions that were developed during the globalization or the intensified globalization era since the end of the Cold War, basically. Trying to, some people argue that this national security aspect of state is no longer important. Countries are becoming less interested in security, so reducing their military forces, spending, they are using international institutions, non-state private security force, etc. There is a big literature in international relations trying to argue that the state is pretty much weakened as a result of globalization. And then these non-state actors such as Al-Qaeda and terrorists are equally playing a big role in the way world politics is conducted. So our testing was conducted on different regions and different issue areas and looking at major states such as the United States, China, Russia, and looking at regions where European Union, Latin America, and South Asia, where how globalization has affected their security calculations. What we find is that after the end of the Cold War, there was a period of retrenchment. Countries reduced military spending, but it went up further slowly now. After 9/11, it has gone to a bigger, especially for the United States. There are some subtle changes taking place. A lot more use of private security providers. A lot more emphasis on fighting transnational crimes and terrorist groups, etc. But still, the big picture spending for the big powers is still non-traditional military capability. Aircraft carriers and the big aircraft and the Chinese are also developing these things. So our reading is that globalization, that phase of globalization has not affected as much as we thought it did. States are adapting and this national security state is alive and kicking. It is not going away anytime soon. Now we talk about deglobalization since the collapse in the, you know, the financial industry. What we are witnessing is that even after this deglobalization, the military spending is still going on because security issues have emerged, increased in some sense. And I don't see the emerging powers like China or India reducing military spending. In fact, globalization has helped them acquire more wealth, and that wealth is being now transferred in a limited way to their military acquisitions. India is building or acquiring aircraft carriers, submarines. China is doing a lot more. And this shows that the national security state is a very powerful state. It is the core function of the state. Although there are fewer wars today, that's probably affected partially by globalization. Or the end of the Cold War, you know, things have changed about the notion of warfare. But at the same time, one has to be cautious. I'm very cautious on the subject of countries will simply give up this notion of fighting wars and things like that. We need to create more proactive institutions, economic structures, and in the developing world, a number of weak states are still in existence where the hub of conflict continues. So do we have instruments? Using the traditional instruments sometimes very difficult. Our conclusion there also is that countries have to take a lead role instead of abandoning the notion of security, but define security in a broader way, not just interstate security.
So beyond national.
Beyond national, but countries still have to take the lead because we don't have any parallel institutions, even the United Nations, enough to give the power that is needed to transform world politics.
Is something, does the Non-Proliferation Treaty with proper adaptation, is it a way, a path to continue down in order to continue this non-use of nuclear weapons?
I think it is definitely an important element of it. And today we are talking about strengthening that treaty. Obama administration has come up with a number of provisions. Arguments about how to strengthen the treaty. There are only three or four holdouts, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea now, and Iran, of course, is violating it as a member, but I don't think it has withdrawn from the treaty. So the treaty has done some good, but the treaty has this bargain between nuclear haves or nuclear and nuclear have-nots. That's the six or the five established nuclear powers who are allowed to keep their nuclear weapons under this treaty. And that is precisely where the non-nuclear states are questioning that logic. The nuclear states haven't reduced in a big way, although since the end of the Cold War there is some reduction. But one of the commitments they made under Article 6, that progressively they will reduce and create a nuclear-free world. This is the first step. NPT is only one step. In return, they're asking the non-nuclear states, don't get them. We are not going to, implicitly they're telling, we are not going to attack you, but you don't get them. But the nuclear states haven't followed through their side of the bargain. This has become a big issue. The NPT has to be reviewed every 5 years. And the last review conference, there was no successful resolution at the end. Usually they pass a resolution because the non-nuclear states question the whole thing. Today, Obama administration is focusing on that by connecting the arms control with Russia and also bringing in other states, create a more comprehensive understanding of a non-proliferation treaty itself and supporting the various components of it, which now include also the CTBT, which is the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, etc. Otherwise, the legitimacy of the claim that the nuclear states make often are difficult to understand. But even with that, I think we need further steps. Further steps could be a kind of a virtual nuclear world where capabilities could be there, but they should disassemble them, de-alert them, take them away, but it's a long way. But clearly a reduced Russia nuclear capability would help a lot. And I think they're talking about 1,000 warheads between the two.
Well, one final question requiring a brief answer because we have limited time. What do you worry most about with regard to the overthrow of the non-use regime?
It depends how and when and where it will happen. Mm-hmm. I cite some arguments suggest that one use may not be too bad, because then the world will be forced to, like Chernobyl, like Hiroshima, Nagasaki. But my argument is that it's unpredictable. What if the use is in a condition where the other guy was clearly threatening the use or something, and that it didn't create much damage as we expected? And then the temptation, okay, maybe we need a weapon that can reduce this collateral damage that we are afraid of. So the big fear is that decision makers were not socialized into this notion of non-use may try to tempt to use this for bargaining purposes without knowing that there is an escalatory process and accidental war taking place, especially in the regional context. That, I think, is a big worry for me in Korean Peninsula as well as in the India-Pakistan context and the Middle East.
TV, on that note, thank you. We've covered a lot of material and very informative about some of the problems we're facing today. Thank you very much. But before I thank you, let me show your new book, Complex Deterrence, Strategy in the Global Age, because in your previous book and in this book, you really go into many of the problems that are going to be merging as we move down the path of strengthening non-use. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank
you very
much. It's a great pleasure talking to you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.